I'd like to add my thanks to Anne for a very stimulating paper. And I will take a very different approach. I will say a little about the broad national policies for culture in the United Kingdom, but I want then to look at one particular issue, the issue of public space in audience development. The question of categorising audiences is one that has concerned us in the United Kingdom as well. And I don't think we've found yet a particularly good solution to this. One of our difficulties is that the categories that we usually use are ones that were developed by government for the census of population, largely because they provide a reasonable level of predictive value for health policy, social policy, and other areas of public policy, but not especially are not especially useful in predictive terms for cultural policy. This means that museums and other cultural institutions have had to try to develop for themselves classifications that they feel work. And by and large, most museums have not really done that terribly successfully. At the V&A, we decided some years ago now that we would try to classify our audiences by the kind of use they made of the museum. I don't claim any great scientific value for this classification, and it's one that is particular to the nature of our collections and our work. And it is pretty simple and pretty crude. We have six categories of audience: schools, who behave in one way; families, who behave in another; students in further and higher education as a third; community groups, a fourth; creative professionals, the so-called creative industries, is a fifth; and other adults, a rather vague category, is a sixth. The students are a very important audience for us. We get about 15% of our visitors from that group, much, much more than most museums do. Creative professionals are a very important group for us. Again, we get about 15% of our audience from that category as well. So you can see that we've shaped our classification around the kinds of people who are using us a lot. Stepping back, in the last few years, the last 10 years perhaps, we have seen radical changes in cultural policy in the United Kingdom. Most obviously, first, free access to the national museums. This has increased the numbers of people visiting our national museums. It has not significantly changed the profile of them. And that, I think, is a very important point. Secondly, the government has invested significantly in regional museums outside London. And also, as part of that, in increasing educational provision in many regional museums too. Possibly connected to that to some degree, there seems to have been a significant increase in the number of people visiting museums in the United Kingdom in recent years. third major initiative in the last year or so is something the government has called the cultural offer for children and young people of school age. And this has set as an objective that every child will experience 5 hours of cultural activity each week, either within school or outside school. So far, only some pilots have been funded and are beginning their work. It's far too easy, far too early to know whether this will be an effective strategy or not in engaging young people in culture. It also raises many questions about what do we mean by cultural participation. And this has not yet been satisfactorily defined by government or the agency which is leading the project. You could argue that it is young people who have decided to exclude museums, quite rationally, and not just museums that have decided to exclude young people. If one takes a young person's focus perspective, then the landscape looks very different from that which appears if you take an institutional perspective. Young people may already be engaged in vastly more than 5 hours of cultural activity each week. It's simply that it's invisible to us or not recognised by us as being legitimate. And that discussion and that debate, I think, is yet to be had. The United Kingdom is the most socially and educationally unequal society among developed countries, with only one exception, the United States. And this is reflected in the profile of UK museum audiences. We still lack a coherent strategy in the UK for audience development. We have no clear national goals. And we're entering a recession in which many of our assumptions in terms of cultural policy and social policy are now open to question. There isn't time to discuss this in detail, but I would just say that museums are going to need to decide what their values are in a situation of increasing social stress, unrest, and fragmentation. I said I wanted to choose just one aspect of audience development, because there isn't really time to look at more. And I wanted to choose one which, rather to my surprise, has revealed a strategy which is much more powerful than I would have expected. And this is the role of public space. And I will give some evidence a little bit to support that claim. Start with a question. What kind of public spaces do we need? I would like to argue that we have about four main kinds of public space from a cultural perspective. Cultural institutions. We're very familiar with those. A 19th century, particularly, invention. Secondly, cultural spaces, such as parks and historic landscapes. Where culture and education are an explicit purpose of the space, but not the only one. Then, open spaces, the streets, the rivers, the wildernesses, where the public has right of access, but which are rarely, if ever, directed to explicit cultural purpose. And then finally, as we've heard, digital space, which has become a dynamic area for cultural activities. And over the last 200 years, we have privileged cultural institutions among those four categories. The full cultural potential of other kinds of public space, I believe, have been wrongly neglected. The proposal, which you may or may not think is radical, I wish to make, is that successful achievement of public policy goals is dependent upon successful integration and work with all of those four kinds of public space. This doesn't mean that museums and other cultural institutions are not important, but it is to argue that they are much less effective if operating in isolation from the other three kinds of public space. And in this really should be seen from the perspective of cultural rights and cultural democracy. Who defines cultural? What constitutes participation? And really crucially, who should manage public spaces for cultural purposes? We regard ourselves as the cultural experts. Is it healthy, nevertheless, that we should try to claim policy ownership of spaces outside cultural institutions as well as inside? And if not us, who? These are, I think, really significant questions for democracy. We have tried to grapple with some of these questions in a small way in the new education centre at the V&A, the Sackler Centre. And we've only opened it now for 5 months. I won't claim to give you any evidence of success or failure yet. I can only tell you what we're trying to do. We were fortunate in having architects who were very sympathetic to listening to audiences as well as listening to the institution in designing it. And we've had spaces which are much more rich and varied and, I hope, accessible than we've had before for audience work. The space cost roughly €6 million to convert from the old gallery spaces. And it's enabled us to work at many levels, income-generating courses, study days and seminars, particularly for students and creative professionals. Showcase student events where students themselves bring their work, their ideas, and present them to the public. And digital programs. One of our most serious commitments is to digital technologies in this space, on the basis that this is what our audiences, and particularly young people, are now using universally. And museums have to embrace the digital. So we have a digital studio, for example. But under all of this, I suppose, is a question as well of what kind of society we're trying to create. And the underlying theme of the Sackler Centre is that we're trying to promote and encourage people to see that they actually have some degree of control and influence over their designed world. And they use design every day. They make design choices, not just as consumers, but also in small or large ways as makers as well. And the Sackler Centre there is to help them to understand those choices and also to help them to develop their skills. And in that, creative professionals have a very important role. There is a triangle of resources that audiences can use. The resources of the museum, the skills of creative professionals, but thirdly also the talents of our visitors, our users, including young people themselves. And those three things, that triangle, only museums can put together. An issue, I think, here is to do with who we value. You may be familiar with the work of Richard Florida, the American writer about creativity and the creative cities, who argues that there is a creative class of 30% of the US workforce. He argues that there are three T's that indicate a city which is friendly to that creative class around technology, talent, and tolerance. And he also has developed a creativity index by which cities can measure, supposedly, their score in fostering a creative class. And I raise this because I think that this is a profoundly undemocratic model. He argues the necessity of a service class of nearly half of the US workforce as a necessity to support the creative class. One can question his methodologies, whether there's any real methodological connection between tolerance and friendliness to gays and technological developments, which are things that he's paired together as his analysis. And then thirdly, as one of the UK's cultural commentators has asked, is this an issue of values, not wealth? Florida is looking at wealth as a measure of success for the creative class, whereas Tom Bentley says again, it's one of values. But if Florida's model is accepted, then it means that museums are really trying to target their efforts on a relatively small group of the audience. This is my extension, not his. But nevertheless, that is the implication of the kind of model that he offers. So I want to then look at public space from another perspective, that of the Exhibition Road Cultural Group, which is the institutions in the part of London in which the Victoria and Albert Museum is located. And as you can see, there are a very large number of them, each of which had been working in isolation until very recently. And you can see there are universities there, performing arts institutions, museums, cultural institutes, such as the Goethe Institute or the Institut Français, a whole variety of kinds of public space, as well as everything else. But the key point is that uniting all of them is the streetscape. That kind of public space, which we had been neglecting terribly. So the transformation of the area had two parts, the redesign of the streetscape and also a development of a joint cultural program. This is our kind of statement of values, if you like, our mission, to develop the talent that's in everyone. Very explicitly not Florida's objective. To see our different functions as mutually supportive, to work together, and to add value through collaboration. Our identity we have tried to develop too, local to global, through activities. We've run nearly 20 public events and activities now, on very large scale ones, over the last 3 or 4 years. So the international dimension is very important. The combination of science and arts, breaking down the divide between the two. The matching of the historical and the contemporary. Seeing culture and education as integral elements of human experience. Seeing knowledge and creativity as being interconnected. Staging major public events out in the street, not just inside our institutions. This event was part of a Notting Hill Carnival program a couple of years ago. International partnerships. Each of our institutions has many dozens of collaborations, partnerships with international organizations, international projects. Collectively, without question, this is the most internationally connected part of London. Large numbers of international students come to study at the institutions of the area. As you can see, over 40% in each of the universities, and a similar percentage of visitors to the museums from abroad. And one particular event, I think, exemplifies what we were trying to achieve. An event about architecture and sound called Explore Sights and Sounds, part of the French Fête de la Musique initiative, which happens each year. And for this, we filled as much of the public space as we could outside our institutions with our architectural installations and activities and with music. We involved local communities such as the Thai Music Circle in providing programmes. These are events that public groups could come to participate in as well as professionals. And these figures, if you like, are some of the basis of my argument. On that one day, we had nearly 70,000 people came into the area to participate in the activities. First-time visitors are relatively few, and that is a concern. However, most of the visitors who'd come before had only ever visited one institution. We increased the number of people who visited more than one institution quite dramatically. And then, I think for me, the crucial point here, BAME is United Kingdom jargon for Black, Asian and minority ethnic visitors. In other words, ethnic diversity. And those figures of a quarter of the people who came to the event are far, far higher than those that ever would come into the Victoria and Albert Museum's doors, or the Science Museum, or the Natural History Museum, or any of our other institutions. Probably twice or three times as many. In other words, the events that we hold in our shared public space, outdoors, are much more inclusive in the audiences that they attract than the events that we run within the institutions. And the audiences that then come into the institutions on those days as well are much more diverse. The people who came into the V&A during Explore Sights and Sounds were much more diverse than the ones that we normally get coming in on other days. This is the evidence, and this is not an isolated example. It's true for virtually every activity that we've run and we evaluate. So this is the argument really for saying that probably the most powerful change we could make in terms of developing our audiences is to integrate our different kinds of cultural spaces and, if you like, work actively outside our walls in the physical environment in proximity to the museums. So I'll stop there.